Now let's get on with the show. As we discussed in a lot of the pre-show work, what we're going to look at this Sunday is, you know, for maritime power with global requirements that we are, you know, what is the role of small ships both in times of peace and times of war? What are the trade-offs we can look at between quantity and capability, size, range, survivability, and especially in a tight budgetary environment, you cannot discount affordability. You know, the Navy in the past has looked at a high-low mix where they've had different groups of high-capable ships and other lower-capable ships. Do we have that mix right? Do we really need that? And also, as we look on a path towards a sustainable, balanced fleet, have the decisions that have been made in the past put us in a position that those making decisions going forward are going to be in an excess challenge? And what are some of the things that we can do now to perhaps set things up for those that follow us in the decades to come to be able to keep the U.S. Navy where it needs to be for the rest of the century? And here we are for the full hour. We have a returning guest, U.S. Naval War College Center for Naval Warfare Studies Dean, Captain Robert C. Rubel, U.S. Navy retired. Barney, welcome back to MidRats.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Just wanted to kind of, as a starting point for the show, back in September this year in Proceedings, you authored an article that really caught my eye, mostly because of the title. And just it's titled, Seed No Water, Strategy, Littorals, and Flotillas. That seed no water, how does that kind of set the stage for the conversation that follows, and why is that concept important?
Well, seed no water is a Sobrowskiism. Admiral Sobrowski, when he was president of the War College, tutored all of us on various aspects of not only network-centric warfare, but how he saw the Navy's ability to operate in the littorals in the future. And he always used the term, we must seed no water. And he had in mind a network force of small combatant street fighters, he called them, among other things, that would allow us to do that. His feeling that being that increasing coastal defenses, littoral defenses, submarines, you know, the whole anti-axis panoply of stuff, would drive capital ships or larger ships out of the littoral or force us to. Now, I have a little bit of direct experience with that in a way, and in fact, this experience kind of formed my whole career, I guess, in the Navy. In 1973, during the Yom Kippur War, I was a brand-new Nugget Aviator, Lieutenant J.G. Flying A-7s, VA-66 on USS Independence. And, of course, we were over in the middle of things there, and what I saw was that the Soviet fleet had us outgunned, the 5th Escadra out there. It had plenty of anti-ship missiles. We didn't have any. We didn't have any anti-ship tactics or really any anti-ship weapons. They kind of had it all. And during that situation, a number of us were talking about, well, maybe we ought to run west through the Straits of Sicily to get untargeted and unlocated, and then maybe fight our way back in. But then we got to thinking, well, no, if we do that, if we run west and get untargeted and unlocated, that's fine tactically, and we could probably fight our way back in, but if we did that, the Soviets would say, okay, wait a minute, they'd go to the UN and say, let's have a negotiation, let's stop in place, and nobody shoot, and we'll negotiate, which would, politically, that'd be kind of hard for the U.S. To overcome, and it would leave them in charge of the Eastern Med, and Israel would have been isolated. That, to me, said, okay, we were in no position to stand and fight in that section of the water. We would, had we chosen to do that, our carriers could have taken some big hits. would we have eventually won? Well, I don't know. You know, we had a submarine force and stuff. The carriers would have gotten hit. And we would have had to run west to get out of there to reset the geometry for an approach battle. We don't want to have to do that. And frankly, our anti-ship capability, our carrier capability is no different now than it was really in 1973. We've got better airplanes. But still, if you properly understand how to use aircraft carriers, you then understand standing and fighting in the literal, you know, a melee-type fight is the last thing you want to do with the carrier. So the question is, how do we stand our ground, so to speak, in the literal? So that's where that all came from.
As I was reading your article in Proceedings, and I've put a link to it on the chat room website, I took a look at the references, the footnotes, and one of them was Julian Corbett, and I thought it was fascinating that he identified this problem, probably not in the same words you would use, but certainly identified the problem of large capital ships and they're not being able to use them under certain conditions. Could you kind of walk through that?
Well, the theoretical construct is that capital ships are associated with seizing command of the sea. In other words, command of the sea, if you understand it correctly, in my view, it is nothing more than a strength relationship between two contending navies. The stronger one has freedom of action that the weaker one does not have. You know, and if you've won a big battle at sea, like Trafalgar, let's say, then you're at liberty to disperse your fleet to exercise sea control in given situations. And that was kind of Corbett's big theoretical breakthrough. It wasn't really a breakthrough. Corbett was interpreting sea power through the British lens, whereas Mahan had interpreted through the American lens. And Mahan was all about fleet concentration. The Brits did not want to concentrate their fleet if they didn't have to, unless there was some compelling threat emanating from the North Sea. So Corbett was saying, okay, if we can defeat that powerful navy, that allows us to disperse our fleet to exercise sea control, protect convoys, do gunboat diplomacy, you know, keep order in the colonies, all the things that they need naval power for around the world. But with the fleet concentrated in home waters, you can't do that very well, where your individual frigates are at risk. I won't go into the whole technical aspect of what frigates meant to the battle fleet and to policing the empire, but they were always in short supply. The point being, capital ships could with seizing and exercising command of the sea, not sea control per se. We have a problem in our terminology in that we think sea control is everything. We incorporate command of the sea and a whole bunch of things in it, and we don't even know how to talk about war at sea anymore. Command at sea is a distinct thing. It's associated with capital ships. Ergo, you only risk capital ships when command of the sea is at stake. You don't risk them when it's only local sea control. So that's where Corbett's coming from. So that's one piece of the equation. The other piece with capital ships is that, they're not good at infighting or melee fights in a constrained set of waters for various reasons. So there's two counts in which capital ships ought to avoid fights where command of the sea is not at stake and where the circumstances of battle do not favor their characteristics.
Sticking with some of the lessons of 73, one of the points that you made is we were kind of caught, the Sixth Fleet was kind of caught flat-footed because it had spent the last decade, you know, focused on power projection in Vietnam and striking land, which is kind of ironic because if you look at the leaders who had been in the Navy 30 years, they cut their teeth during World War II. And if you look at what we have been doing for the last 13 years in the Long War, the Global War on Terror, however you wanted to describe it, kind of stepping back a bit, are there some things that we have just become so ingrained with our day-to-day operations of the fleet over the last 13 years that we might be putting ourselves in a position of having some assumptions that could be quickly not valid or that set us up to be caught flat-footed again?
Yeah, I mean, this is the reason Admiral Greenert came into the office saying, warfighting first, operate forward, be ready, warfighting first. He was concerned, rightly so, that we had lost our warfighting edge at sea. Like you say, for the last 13 years, actually 23 years probably, since Desert Storm, what the Navy's been doing is feeding sorties into an ATO fight ashore. And the carriers act as airfields at sea. That's a doctrinal role, only one of many doctrinal roles a carrier can perform. And each doctrinal role has a certain risk matrix associated with it. I got an article in the War College Review in 2010 on the future of aircraft carriers that goes over all that. But we have been focusing on power projection over land almost exclusively, with just minor incidents like the dust up we had with Iran at one point in the 90s, I think it was, and with Libya. But that's it. We've been focusing on power projection, and that's what happened to us in 73. The Navy, and you say leaders cut their teeth on stuff in World War II. Yeah, but leaders end up getting wrapped up in organizational agendas. The Navy was, I've watched the Navy get caught with its pants down in other areas too. Like I was a skipper of a Hornet squadron when Saddam invaded Kuwait and we showed up in the Red Sea. And the Navy had zero idea of how to conduct a theater air campaign. We're all very qualified in conducting one-time strikes like El Dorado Canyon, but repeated strikes in an air campaign, we had no idea. So we had no way to argue command and control with the Air Force. They had it right anyway, but after the war, we tried to stuff a JFAC on a ship. We spent years and a lot of money doing that and realized it was the wrong thing to do finally. But we showed up totally unready for a theater air campaign, and there's been other things too. These organizational agendas arise that are formed by whatever's going on at the time, and frankly, we get complacent by lack of threat and wrapped up in the flavor of the kind of operation du jour that we're doing. So we seem to have an institutional problem with looking ahead and being ready for things that don't seem to be very likely.
Well, it seems to me, though, that a lot of the thinkers that we look to in the Navy, you know, Captain Hughes and Admiral Schabowski and others, have all taken a look at the problems that they foresee coming down the road. They're coming down on the side of smaller, faster, more maneuverable ship types, smaller ships, more heavily armed for fights in the littorals, and as you say, I think in your article, melee type operations. Where's the disconnect between where the thinkers, and I'll put you in that crowd too, and Milan Vega and a few others, and what our fleet is actually up to? How did we end up with something the size of the LCS? It's not exactly a small, highly maneuverable ship for the inshore waters.
Yeah, the short answer, it's called N8. That's kind of unfair. I don't mean to be throwing rocks at them, but and it's not totally their fault. But here's the problem. They do a thing called campaign analysis, which is modeling and simulation-based type of analysis. You may be familiar with it, but they use many runs of these models, and they will insert something like LCS into it and other things, and they have ways of determining whether they're cost effective or not. The campaign analysis is not cheap to do, so they can't just throw anything in there and let's try this, let's try that. No, it's a pretty disciplined, rigorous methodology. But the problem with it is that it's kind of a blinded look at the world. It only looks at specific programs that are agreed upon to put in there. So they'll model. It takes time and money to model LCS or model anything, and so that process that is used in N8 to kind of determine Navy budget, and they do that because the other services do it, and it's needed for budget justification. That tends to channel your examination of things, and so stuff like Street Fighter or Wayne Hughes's Cushing's or any number of other things are not easily accommodated by that process, and so they don't make the they get left on the cutting room floor, so to speak.
When we look at the smaller ships, and we'll just go back in our collective professional background, you look back at the 73 war, we had the Asheville class, we brought on the PHM hydrofoils, we got the PCs where we gave them back to the Coast Guard, so no, we want those back. And now we have LCS. That's been the U.S. effort to attempt to intellectualize that small side of the equation. Now, if you had an opportunity to jump on the back of your unicorn with two bags of pixie dust, and you could go about looking at what other navies and other nations have looked at that problem and have built, or have, like the Israelis have contracted with others to build, are there some small combatants that are being produced out there that if you could wave your wand and have us get some, or to have us look serious at producing some, what class of ships out there you think are closer to the answer to the question that Sarah Browski and others initiated that got us to where we are today?
Well, at this point, I'm going to have to take a circuitous route here, because I think it's wrong to talk about ships. We're talking about ship designs prematurely. I mean, that's what we did with LCS before we understood the problem we were trying to solve with them. So there's a lot of good little foreign ships, that are made by any number of countries that we could buy cheaply and press into service. That's not the problem here. I kind of anticipated a little bit of a question like, if you were king, what would you ask for? And let me read you my list. Top of the list, good anti-ship missiles and good targeting, reloadable at sea. Number two, tri-service expeditionary doctrine and capability, tri-service being Army, Navy Department, and Air Force. Three, new torpedoes and mines that are better. Three, a flotilla command. I don't care what's in it. I want the command first, the commander and his staff, and I'll go into that later. And then five, a focus on left of launch. It's a lifestyle, not a tactic. All right. So nothing in that laundry list is a ship or a platform. Unless and until we break out of the group, like the carrier battle group or the amphibious ready group model of fighting, then you're going to come up with something that is at least the size of LCS, because that's the way you think about naval warfighting, is in the group structure. If you think outside the group, a flotilla, for example, then you transition to a different way of thinking about naval warfighting. Once you get that fleshed out, once you figure out what that mode of fighting is going to look like, what the main killing weapon is, which I think is the missile, once you figure that out in its operational aspects, then you can start thinking about what kind of ship you need. I mean, there's other things to consider, too, like seakeeping ability, strategic mobility versus not having strategic mobility, basing structure, stuff like that. But, you know, we focus right on the ships, and it's way too premature to discuss them intelligently. I mean, we're discussing them in a vacuum. A lot of people know a lot of things about ships, but to me, it doesn't matter until you understand how you're going to fight.
Are we, along those veins, are we missing a strategy that will help us, guide us along that path of what we plan to do with in the future? Is that part of the problem?
Well, yeah, sort of. Let me give you three propositions here, each of which is contestable. I'm sure you know people that will fall on either side of these, but let me give you these three propositions, and then we can talk about that. Proposition one, the U.S. Navy must be forward with power to underpin U.S. voice and influence forward, because that's what we want, voice and influence forward. Proposition two, each region demands a different kind of naval force because the geography is different. The politics are different. Everything's different in these different regions. So what works in one region won't work as well in another region. Proposition three, the missile has replaced the airplane as the key killing weapon at sea. All right. Now, if you accept these propositions, and I'm sure you all know people that don't accept one or more of these, but let's say we accept them, if you buy it, then we should have adequate missile power forward. Now, what's adequate? Well, it depends. But it's still missile power forward. This power can and should be distributed for reasons that Wayne Hughes and Art Zabrowski can go into or have gone into. Then three, the smaller, and I say smaller, I don't know what smaller is, something smaller than a Burke, missile combatant becomes a disruptor that prevents aggression, military aggression via the sea. It's a disruptor, okay? That's kind of how we maintain the international system, you know, the law of the sea, the whole international order. Now, if you don't buy these, one or more of these propositions, for instance, Proposition 1, forward with power, if you don't buy that, then you think, okay, it's time to bring the Navy home and adopt a surge status, like the CNA tipping point study said. If you say, well, no, you know, one size fits all, what we need is strategic mobility and flexible combatants that can, you know, be useful everywhere, then you don't believe each region demands a fundamentally different kind of naval force. And you may still believe that the airplane, that the F-35, the F-18, are still kings of the sea, and the missile hasn't really proved itself. So if you buy those, then we need, if you buy all three, I believe it points to a flotilla of some kind forward, and the flotilla that's in East Asia or the one that's in the South China Sea, is it looks different than the one that's in the Persian Gulf, which looks different than the one that's in the Caribbean or off the west coast of Africa. So we can argue about these propositions, but fundamentally, if you think, as I do, that the missile has replaced the airplane as the key killing weapon at sea, then you have to change the way you do business.
Yeah, I would, not that I'm suggesting it, I would love to do a whole show just on anti-ship cruise missile and lightweight torpedoes, but we probably have to find a way to do that behind the door. When you hit on that, that just really, that's something that I hope we have lots of really good, smart people talking to other really smart people to kind of ratchet that down. I want to keep pulling the string, though, on the...
Can I break in here just
absolutely.
A second? I want to assure you that I have these advanced study groups that students join here at the college, and we have been wargaming all of this stuff at the TSSCI level for the last 11 years continuously. These are games that don't stop. They just keep rolling. And we leave no detail unexamined. And so while I can't divulge a lot of this stuff, I want you to have confidence that we have looked at this stuff over and over, every which way you can think of. It's more like we did in the 1920s and 30s here with War Plan Orange.
Yeah.
And we share this with the forward fleets. The forward fleets are avid users of our output. The CNO is too. And we don't, in these games, at least so far, we haven't. We explore future warfare with the stuff we got. We don't insert stuff that doesn't exist into these games. Although we're going to start doing that at the CNO's behest. So that may start to change things.
Yeah, it's just one of the old things. If it doesn't make a shadow on the ramp or displace water, you got to be careful what you take into consideration. The wanted to pull a string again on the flotillas in the ship, because I think the American naval requirements very similar to our predecessor in that regard, the Royal Navy. The tyranny of distance. And being able to support in the transition from peace to war your forward deployed forces that may not be fully able to sustain themselves, or at least retract, kind of what you were looking at back in 73 if you had to move west. And two little details come to mind. During World War One, you had German Admiral Graf Spee's Asiatic Fleet, where most of the fleet met their end off the Falkland Islands as they were trying to get home. And, of course, the Emden did what she could do in the Indian Ocean before she wound up at the Caicos Islands. And you also had, in World War II, the ABDA fleet at the initial part of the war. These were forward-deployed forces right there up front. And if you're looking at smaller ships and flotillas, are there some assumptions and things that we can do to mitigate those risks in transition from peace to war, because there might not be as much warning as we predict? For instance, one thing we talked about last week was some of the experiments with Ponce, whether we need to look at, if not a tender, those type of capabilities if you don't have ready access to facilities ashore in secure locations. What are some things that we can mitigate on those types of occurrences? Or do you feel that our allies and our overseas base structures are such that they give us a little bit of depth towards that concern?
Well, if you have an opponent that has reach at sea, whether it be through aircraft, missiles, ships, submarines, logistics quickly become problematic. And it doesn't matter whether those logistics are sea-based or land-based. I mean, the days are past when you can just get lost at sea. People have ways of finding you. It's not 100%. I mean, it's not like you're a pinned bug, but still, it is harder nowadays to get lost and stay lost at sea to where they don't know where you are. Now, there's techniques, but I would say that the Battle of the Atlantic in World War II, from the German perspective, is a bit illustrative. There was no way, because of Allied air surveillance and radar, there was no way they could have surface vessels act as tenders for their submarines, at least not for very long. So they developed the idea of a Milchkow, which was a supply submarine that would go out and refuel, reprovision, retorpedo, etc. It just highlights that kind of problem. I mean, we're trying to operate forward, and they've got air surveillance, space surveillance, ELINT, you know, all kind of other stuff. So whether it's fixed bases or mobile bases, i.e. motherships, logistics are going to be difficult any way you cut it. And it doesn't matter whether it's for large ships or for small ships. The problems are different for large ships and small ships. I mean, yeah, a Burke class, you know, as long as they're not zorching around full out, can stay at sea for quite a while. But they got X number of missiles, and, you know, once you've shot them, you got to almost go back to Hawaii to get them reloaded. Smaller ship, but if you're, you know, a carrier trying to operate, you know, you may have a week's full worth of full-out flight ops, but then at some point you're going to have to, bring on board more jet fuel and maybe weapons and stuff like that. So at some point you got to find some sanctuary somewhere to mount your logistics. Now, small ships obviously require more logistics, or let me put it this way, they require more frequent fill-ups of one thing or another than do large ships. We don't know what it takes, and, you know, people can argue all they want, but it's all data-free research. We haven't done the specific research needed to figure out what kinds of logistics are required for what kinds of small combatants. This is one of the reasons I'm advocating just priority, create a flotilla command, commission it, put an officer in charge, give them a small staff, and then in the first instance we can simulate our way through. It's a virtual flotilla. We just populate it with different stuff and simulate and game our way through it continuously for a year, maybe more. At some point, it transitions to a real one, or maybe you take the guy, whoever's in charge of the LCSs out in Singapore now, make that a flotilla group, and let them operate and let them exercise and figure it out. Just work your way through it. Kind of what I got in mind are, you know, the old places, not bases things. You have a moving set of places where ships can get fuel, food, etc., whether it be from a ship or some stock of things, you know, 50-gallon drums hidden on an island somewhere or something like that. I don't know. But, I mean, you use a combination of stuff like that, knowing that the other guy's going to come looking, trying to disrupt your logistics, and has the capability to attempt it anyway. But to say a priori, small ships are bad because they require logistics, well, no, everybody requires logistics as forward. It's just the dynamics are different.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the article that you cited that had in your September piece and proceedings on the Russians in the Eastern Med mentioned the fact that they lacked the bases. They came up with all kinds of, I don't want to call them necessarily innovative, but they had to find different ways to refuel and fix their ships since they didn't have a good home port. They were able to do it pretty effectively, it looks like.
Yeah, they were, as long as nobody was shooting at them. And that was one of their weaknesses. The problem for us was they were set up to fight a battle of the first salvo. So they were going to do their damage in the first 20 minutes. had the fight developed into a longer-term thing, they weren't going to do so well because we would have gone after their logistics and they would have had to withdraw.
Well, that kind of cuts to the argument you have. I mean, as an old Service Force guy myself on the right and ammo ship, I'm pretty well aware of how logistics worked off Vietnam. In fact, and during the time you were bouncing around in the Med, I was out in the West back someplace. But, you know, all that aside, what we have this flotilla command, which an idea, which a concept I agree with. If you were king of the flotilla command, what would you be asking for people to look at as far as what makes a flotilla? Where would you? I mean, is that driven by geographics, as you suggested earlier? Is there some other concepts you'd think of?
Yeah, I mean, if I was the flotilla commander, in the South China Sea or East China Sea, somewhere like that. Yeah, I'd be looking at and let's just take our mind experiment this path. In the first instance, I'm commander of a virtual flotilla, so you know I get the modelers to make me any damn thing I want, and it's no big deal. I would have them model me a range of different ships, ranging from a Visby class all the way up to a Burke, and I'd want to have some of each available to me as I go through, and I just play with them and see which one works. I mean, that's the best way in the virtual world. Now, in the physical world, of course, I can't ask for carte blanche, a whole bunch of stuff, or wait a minute, maybe I can go back to the idea of purchasing foreign ships. Why can't we purchase a Visby and a couple different things of various sizes and characteristics and just play with them?
I would think that would be a great idea and an experimental squadron just to play out. But I think it'd probably get lost somewhere between one side of Congress or the other. As an interim, just something that popped into my head because, one thing you mentioned about, there's a tendency to always think about the ships and the platforms. But backing up to the intellectual side of the house, one of the things I always found that was curious is it's almost at best a neutral tour, but there's a lot to be gained from taking some of our sharpest officers and letting them go on exchange tours. The British, the Australians are the usual ones. We had, I think, three or four people actually were deployed, American officers deployed to the French on their carrier during the Libyan ops. And it would be great if we could get some of our top guys in and be a JO on a Visby and things of that manner. Do you see selectively targeting perhaps some exchange tours? I don't think you'd have any trouble getting enough people to go to Sweden for 2 to 3 years if it didn't impact their career too much. Could that be a compromise way to, if we can't get the physical ships inside our lifelines, at least perhaps we can get some of the intellectual effort with that experience?
Yeah, of course. When I taught, and I taught for over 7 years in the Joint Military Ops Department here at the War College, the most creative and enthusiastic and aggressive students that I had were guys that had just come from command of a PC. There's something about commanding one of those things that just lights people's fire. And I think that any opportunity an officer has to serve on something small like that, especially when they're junior, obviously, is an incredibly educational and stimulating professional experience. If I was a junior SWO, I would be jumping at a chance for something like that. And that's another way we could get at it, maybe, although it's there's a lot of mines in those waters is instead of buying Visbys or something like that, just lease them already manned from the Swedes and exercise with them, you know, pay them for rent the ship for a while with its crew, but maybe put a couple of U.S. officers aboard as observers, or maybe the XO or something like that. But some way to develop that experience and to develop a something other than a academic understanding of what the promise and pitfalls are with these ships.
As long as we're going down the path of as you said, the kind of the mind exercise, as we develop more and better unmanned vessel, how big a role would you foresee them playing in something like the flotilla that you would contemplate?
Oh yeah, in fact, I'm making a pitch at the strategy discussion group. I think it's this Wednesday. You know, we were supposed to do it last week, but we got snowed out. You know, Robbie Harris's strategy discussion group. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So Wayne Hughes, John Harvey, and myself are going to pitch at this this thing coming up. I'll have to do it VTC, as will Wayne and Jeff Klein. But my piece of the action is I'm going to provide a vision of a flotilla that is an amalgam of manned and unmanned systems. Unmanned systems may include vehicles, probably will, surface, subsurface, air, but also arrays and things like that. And I've collected pictures of neat things. This thing called a guard bot. It can go on water or land. It looks like a just kind of a beach ball with bug eyes on either side. But you know, it can roll along the water and then roll up on the land. You know, now what if that thing had sensors, which it does? It's got cameras, I think. But what if it had decoy transmitters in it, stuff like that? My whole idea is turning geography against the other guy. You know, we kind of assume that, you know, when we're in the other guy's literal, geography's on his side. It ain't necessarily so. We can turn it against him. But now that represents a very different way of thinking about naval combat than we're used to. But one great way to help turn geography against the other guy is extensive use of arrays, moles, I call them, which are either, you know, mines, captors, different kinds of things laying on the bottom or floating around in the water in various ways that only start doing their thing under certain conditions or when you tell them to. So the flotilla becomes an array of manned and unmanned things whose purpose is to turn geography against the other guy. And I think we have examples in World War II, especially the Solomons campaign, but more broadly in the Pacific, where the Japanese, for instance, they may have been an island nation, but they pursued a continental-style strategy. It was all about the central position and strong points and garrisons and stuff like that. And they became, at various points in the war, overly fixated on land features. And that resulted, for instance, in their loss at Midway. It resulted in their forces getting chewed up in the Solomons campaign. There are some other examples. But, you know, the people that we're most likely to fight are continental powers. They're focused on land features. And we can bend that to our advantage, make them make mistakes that will ultimately do in their navies. And a combination of manned and unmanned systems working in unison or cooperation can make that happen, I believe.
And to go ahead and use the C word, China, when you look at their strategy, and I like the point that you made about, you know, traditional continental powers focusing on the land side. and view of things. And you can see some of that in the discussion of the first island chain, the second island chain, you know, where are the pieces of land I can point my fingers to. And one phrase I'd like to use on when talking about at least my view of what the Chinese do, and other people have as well, is kind of about the porcupine strategy, where, you know, this is my body of water. I'm going to make it so painful for you and difficult for you to come in here that, you know, the whole sea denial point of view. Huh? When you look at the ships that we've been building, DDG 1000, DDG 51 Flight 3, LPD 17, the other large deck amphibs, and of course our carriers, especially on the amphib side of the house, is we build these large ships that, from an economic point of view, look relatively cost effective because, hey, I can move more people in one unit, but that also puts you at some significant risk if you have to go after the porcupine, that if you do lose one of your ships, you've lost a huge percentage of your capability. And are we not really fully taking on board the concept of distributing risk as well as distributing our offensive power, so we're willing to take some pretty hard hits but still be able to go through and try to achieve the mission fight hurt at the operational level?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, I go back to the 1982 Falklands War when a lucky hit by an Argentine Exocet got the Atlantic Conveyor. Now, that was just a row ship, but it had all their helicopters on it, and damn near did in the whole operation because the focus was on land, obviously. So the Brits had to yomp across the East Falkland Island. So, but that's an example of a key ship type where you put so much capability, whether it be firepower or logistics, into one hull, the loss of that thing dries up your operation. I mean, that's what you want to avoid. Now, go back to the lucky part of it. I believe, based on all the work we've done over the last decade or so here up at Newport here, is that it is wrong to think there can be a bastion at sea of any kind. Something's going to get through. You'll intercept some stuff, but you won't intercept everything. The Argentines weren't particularly adept fighters, and yet one of their Exocets got through. One of them got the Sheffield. You can say, well, she was unready and everything, but, you know, in fact, they were ready for the attack that got Atlantic Conveyor, and in fact, that missile was probably aimed for a destroyer or something else, and their chaff decoyed enough to where it missed them, but it ends up hitting the Atlantic Conveyor. That should be an object lesson to us. There ain't no such thing as a bastion at sea. If you accept that premise, that there is no such thing as a bastion at sea, then you really do want to distribute your combat power. Sobrowski, to get back to him, used to have this concept of tactical stability. And what he meant by that is if you drew a graph of the x-axis being the offensive power of a ship and the y-axis being its defensive power, what you see is the offensive power increases. You know, you can draw a line at a 45-degree angle. As a ship gets bigger, you know, the offensive power and defensive power increase proportionally, except at some point the offensive power keeps increasing, but there's a knee in the curve, and the defensive power starts falling off. In other words, it doesn't grow as fast as the offensive power does. And at that point, in his view, that's one part of it in my view, but he was looking at individual ships. I look at the force, the whole force. And tactical stability means that you can degrade gracefully, that a single ship getting taken out doesn't dry up your operation. You can keep fighting. But it does suggest that if you combine that with the idea that there is no bastion at sea, it suggests that you distribute your combat power among a bunch of units. Now, how many depends on a whole bunch of things, but it's not just a few large things. So, yeah, tactical stability suggests that you distribute your combat power. And this is what Wayne Hughes has been working on for a long time. Now, you may or may not agree with his solution of an 800-ton combatant, but if you believe missiles are king and there's no such thing as a bastion at sea, then you, by God, better distribute your combat power among a bunch of things and pack them with missiles.
Yeah, I was just reading Hughes on that very topic. I mean, he said exactly what you said, which is you can't, if you take out one large ship that has everything on it, then you're pretty much screwed. So
yeah.
He wanted the dispersal.
Now, all this stuff gets mixed up. We conflate
things. Yes,
it does. So it sounds like I'm talking about aircraft carriers, and I'm not exactly talking about aircraft carriers. They may be included, but like if you go from the littoral of East Asia into the Persian Gulf, what we believe from our gaming is that the carrier is still king there, and it's going to be king for a long time, not necessarily inside the Gulf, but if you use them smartly, it's your the TAC air is the killing weapon there. That's the thing that's going to deliver victory to us. And so I am not condemning aircraft carriers in all times and all places. I am condemning using them for the wrong reasons in the wrong places.
Eagle One?
Well, I was in total agreement, stunned into total agreement. No, I think Admiral Harvey made that point, and maybe former Secretary, Undersecretary Work too, when they were on recently, that the carrier has a role in the Navy for the foreseeable future, and because they really are very versatile ships. But I don't think in my view, and I think what you're saying too, is that does not mean that you can't have this smaller, lighter, more dispersed force that's extremely powerful that you can try different things with. It doesn't cost you an arm and a leg to put a missile-equipped USV or four missile-equipped USVs on a small ship and put it out someplace, as opposed to having to build some a DDG 1000 or something. It's just it complicates the other guy's targeting problems, among other things.
Well, I would love to have a missile as good as the Sunburn, Sizzler, or Shredder missile that the other guy's got, and then stuff them into shipping containers where you get your targeting externally, and all you have to do is put like 220-volt power into the thing and push a button, and it gets itself ready to launch, and then the launch signal comes from external, somewhere in the JIFMIC probably. But if you do that, then everything is a missile threat to the other guy. And, you don't have to build anything specifically. The San Antonio class becomes an arsenal ship. The LCS becomes something with real teeth. The Burke class can reload at sea in a war at sea fight. All kinds of things become possible.
Yeah, I think the Russians were selling those Club in a Box. Was that
Club K? Yeah. Well, I don't know that they ever built it, but it was a hell of a nice computer-generated imagery commercial.
It was.
it gave you plenty to ponder and think about. While we're kind of attacking planning assumptions, well, one of my favorite exercises in some ways is, when you look back and kind of to tie in what we were talking about is, vulnerability mitigation, to roll back in one of the things we talked about earlier on in the show about when you have a Navy or any organization that has been used to operating in a certain environment that it forgets or just doesn't have the time or the money to really address those things that they're just kind of assuming away. And one thing that we've done in conjunction, and I think back when we were kids back in the Cold War, we didn't assume that we owned the electromagnetic spectrum. We would operate MCON a lot, whether it's active or passive, giving or receiving. We knew that the electronic spectrum was going to be contested. But we've become, after the Cold War, we've made a lot of assumptions. We assume that a GPS is always going to be there, that we are always going to have access to SATCOM, and if our military satellites don't do it, then we'll go buy it off of the bandwidth someplace else, and that we're going to be able to attack, aviate, navigate, communicate, do war at sea using all these systems, and nobody's going to plug it, block it, spoof it, and things of that manner. Is that really something that we need to be real cognizant of as we keep talking about network-centric warfare, taking data, having it processed, you know, off-shift, offshore, coming back in? Or is this a planning assumption that maybe we've gotten too comfortable with?
Well, yeah, I mean, in that respect, again, I go back to Admiral Greenert, who I think came into office feeling like he wanted to get the Navy to rediscover its warfighting reflexes. We've become kind of couch potatoes because there has been no threat. And we pedal as hard as we can on it, or the Navy does on a day-to-day basis, just meeting the demands of the COCOMs, whether it be, you know, supplying people and sorties to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, or the theater security cooperation activities that happen in theater, disaster relief, all that kind of stuff. The Navy stretched as tight as a rubber band. And so where's the opportunity to exercise against what? You know, when there hasn't been anything out there until recently. And this has been problematic. So the Navy hasn't done anything that you wouldn't expect. But there again, you know, if we're a bunch of couch potatoes and all of a sudden we're asked to get up and run a 15K, it might be a problem, especially in the electronic warfare spectrum and everything from space to cyber to jamming, you know, all the EW stuff. I mean, we talk a lot about it now, and that's a good thing. But there's a lot of work to be done. And here again, I worry that we focus so much on platforms that we don't talk enough about black boxes and how we're going to keep rebuild our networks. Because, you know, don't we have to kind of assume that our satellites are going to go away? That if we have a war with China, don't you think they're probably going to find some way to take out our satellites, knowing how dependent we are on them? And so we're going to have to rebuild our networks with air breathers, where I see a role of the carrier, where you got these long-range and endurance UAVs operating off a carrier. It can sit way back and then just support the battle space by creating line-of-sight networks, network communications, as well as ISR. And that supports the shooters, who are the small boats and the subs and stuff that have the missiles that are going to do the dirty work.
Eagle One?
I think I just muted myself. very fast hour, Barney. Yeah, we probably keep you for another hour or two. If you want to stay, we'll be happy to do that.
Well, I'm fine, but you guys are probably paying for airtime here.
Let me ask you, before I let you go, and I really want to thank you for coming on today. It's been fascinating, and as I say, very quick. What have you got coming up that we can all look at and read and learn more from in the immediate future?
Let's see here. In addition to that September proceedings article, I had one in the Naval War College Review, in the autumn review on the, I call it National Policy in the Post-Systemic Navy, kind of leveraging Sam Huntington's 1954 article, and there's a lot of stuff at the strategic level in there. I'm making my pitch at the strategy discussion group Wednesday, I believe it is. I'll probably make that available via the somebody in the blogosphere and stuff like that. I've got a couple of more articles drafted on various things that you'll see appearing in Proceedings and other places in the spring. I'm working on one. I don't know where I'm going to try to publish it, but it's called A World Without Capital Ships, ? Talking about a lot of these issues, but I try to make it in a more structured manner. There'll be various things. Although, to be honest, I'm retiring in July, and I'll probably keep writing, but maybe even be a blogger. I don't know. But after 48 years of naval service, I figured it's enough. I got grandkids spread out all over. I want to see, et cetera.
There's a low barrier to entry to the blogosphere, so you come join the rest of us slackers if you got some spare time.
Yeah, Sal and I are living proof of the low barrier. That's true.
But
you're doing us all a service. I think the discussion out there is much richer and more extensive because of the bloggers.
A little bit of spicy equation. Do appreciate you taking time this afternoon, and hopefully you get everything set up and start packing your boxes for retirement.
Yeah, if anybody wants a nice log home in New England, I got one for sale.
There's a reason we live in the South. It has to do with that white stuff that comes out of the sky.
Yeah, I know. My driveway is 280 feet long, and I was shoveling it this morning.
Wow. You can log that as PT.
Yeah, I did.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great holiday season.
Yeah, you guys too.
Thank you very much.
Keep up the good work.
Yes, sir. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us here. And obviously, we're going to have a best of next week for the holiday season. Hope everybody has a nice full tummy and a very safe new year. And we'll see you in 2014. Until then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Out here.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.
Why pay hundreds more in taxes and fees on your wireless bill? Introducing T-Mobile One, now with taxes and fees included. Get four lines for $40 each per month with AutoPay. Switch your family of four to T-Mobile and get a $600 prepaid card. It's kind of like a refund on the taxes and fees you paid to those other guys last year. Don't wait. Visit a T-Mobile store.
Top 3% of data users greater than 28 gigabytes per month may notice reduced speeds. Sales tax and regulatory fees included. Effective with February charges via prepaid MasterCard card. See store for details.